we're discussing the Ebola crisis and lessons to carry forward in the COVID-19 pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Paul Farmer has crisscrossed the world as a public health pioneer, working with governments of Haiti, Kazakhstan, treating AIDS and drug-resistant tuberculosis in southern Africa. He was on the ground as part of the international response in West Africa in the 2014 Ebola epidemic, bearing witness to tens of thousands of healthcare workers contracting Ebola while caring for the sick and the dead, some without the necessary PPE. What can be done to improve public health clinical responses around the world? Do you go on medical relief mission trips? What have you learned? What do you want to know about the cause of Ebola through a spillover event? 800-642-1234. Dr. Paul Farmer is a Kolokotrenes University professor at Harvard University, where he chairs the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. His new book is called Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History. Dr. Farmer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's look at the current situation first. The World Health Organization has asked six African nations to be on alert for a resurgence of the Ebola virus. What does this look like right now?
Well, this is the same part of the world, the same part of West Africa where the big epidemic began at the end of 2013 in what used to be called the forested region of Guinea. And I don't have data from over the weekend, but we know there have already been 18 cases. 14 of those are confirmed, 4 dead. Again, at this stage of the outbreak, all of those numbers are subject to pretty drastic revision. The good news compared to what we faced in 2014 is that now there is a vaccine for Ebola, an effective or a number of effective and safe vaccines. And so they're being deployed right now. The numbers so far, though, are less than 2,000 doses of the vaccine were administered in what's called a ring vaccination pattern. And maybe we'll get back to that if you see fit, Kate.
Yeah, and the UN said Friday there are 30,000 Ebola vaccines available out of a global stock of 500,000. Are there enough vaccines?
There are not enough vaccines, certainly not to do an aggressive ring vaccination strategy. But it would be a typical proportion, however. The great majority of all these Ebola outbreaks occur on the continent of Africa, and 30,000 out of 500,000 to 1,000,000 is these are the kind of fractions that fracture a lot of health authorities in Africa.
Ebola is a zoonosis. It's caused by a pathogen that jumps from animals to humans. What do scientists now understand about this spillover event?
Well, when you mess with Mother Nature, you have a lot of problems, and that's one way just to describe human history, one long messing with Mother Nature. So the disruption of the natural habitats of these viruses and their host creatures is being disturbed by all kinds of developments that have been going on a long time. Now there's a little bit more surveillance capacity so that when there's an outbreak of a disease, a sudden febrile illness that causes death, there's more of a capacity to track it. But tracking the disease and controlling it is not the same as providing care for it. So this is the dilemma that we saw back then. It's going to be the dilemma that's faced now.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Ebola virus with Dr. Paul Farmer. He chairs the Global Health and Social Medicine Department at Harvard Medical School. He was an international responder to the 2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa. You can join in. How do you feel about the current situation there? Are you concerned it will become mixed with COVID and come to the U.S.? What support do you think Africa needs in getting the virus under control? 800-642-1234. You've mentioned revaccination. How long does a vaccine last for Ebola?
Well, excuse me. I was using the term ring, like the three rings of power. But revaccination, unfortunately, is very much a topic on everyone's mind because of COVID and because of the emergence of new variants that may be either more infectious or more lethal. So revaccination and how long the vaccines can endure is a pressing question for both Ebola and COVID. Of course, we know a little bit more about Ebola. I think we have reason to believe that the vaccines that were developed in the course of the 2014, I'll just call it the 2014 West African epidemic, appear to be safe and offer enduring protection. And indeed, some of the technology developed in responding to Ebola is already being used in developing new COVID vaccines. So that's already one bit of really a benefit from having endured that past Ebola outbreak is the vaccine. And remembering old ways of vaccinating, like ring vaccination. And what that means is that when someone has been documented to have Ebola or COVID, they're all the people they're in contact with, and that's called contact tracing is what reveals who's been in contact with them. Those people are offered a vaccine, the ring around them, and then the ring around those people. And you could keep going out with these concentric rings. But as you can see, Kate, this is all built on trust, on some ability to expect that people who are being targeted for these services don't think of themselves as targets in any other way.
Well, trust as well as having adequate medical services. I mean, you talk about medical deserts and in the areas of Central and, you know, Africa being a haven for epidemics. Can you describe for us what a medical desert is like?
Well, a medical desert is just a metaphor drawn from other ways of describing penury, like a food desert. And we have plenty of them in the United States, or a trauma desert, as when one flank of the city of Chicago doesn't have access to adequate trauma services, as was the case there not too long ago. So a clinical desert is a place where you don't have the staff, the stuff, the space, and the systems to respond effectively. So the staff, in the case of Ebola, needs to include ICU nurses and others capable of managing critical illness. The stuff includes, as we're discussing now, vaccines, if we're lucky enough, as we now are with both of those pathogens. The space involves Ebola treatment units or COVID isolation facilities. Sometimes they're even hotels. And then the systems are what allow us to have an adequate surveillance, testing, and response program. For example, the ring vaccination efforts in Guinea going on right now are part of a systematic and systems-approached response to the Ebola outbreak.
You mentioned intensive care units, ICUs. Sierra Leone didn't have any ICUs during the Ebola crisis. So as a public health worker on the ground, what do you do? How do you make, makeshift hospitals and intensive care units?
Well, you've just said what we do. If there's no ICU on the ground, you really have to build one. And those, got popularized as MASH hospitals, mobile army surgical hospitals. And the implication being, of course, is that they could be erected quickly. And we've seen that in the response to COVID in China, or when we open up a cavernous armory or something in an American city. So you can respond to it rather rapidly if you have the requirements, the staff, space, and systems. And if they're not there, then you bring them there. And that's what was attempted in West Africa. It's just there was so much focus on disease control and containment that there wasn't enough focus on care. I'm not sure that's the same problem we're facing now with COVID in the United States. It's a related problem, but there are different stresses and strains on the system when it's not really a medical desert, but is weak in systems approaches to responding to epidemic disease. And that's the United States.
Harvard professor Dr. Paul Farmer, chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. We're examining West Africa's Ebola outbreak, the largest in recorded history, and what this crisis in recent years says about humanity's public health response to deadly viruses. His book is called Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds. What do you remember of the Ebola crisis? Have you been part of a medical humanitarian relief mission? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're spending the hour with infectious disease specialist Paul Farmer, who was at the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak in 2014. His book is part memoir written before the COVID pandemic, and he wrote most of it while in Sierra Leone, a country at the time, as we've been saying, where there was no ICU to speak of, not even in the capital, Freetown. But many hospitals and clinics still have the ability to offer skilled nursing care in the fight against Ebola. What do you want to know about the world of disease control? 800-642-1234. Dr. Paul Farmer, founded Partners in Health, is a Harvard professor of global health and social science. He stays with us. Dr. Farmer, do some comparisons and contrasts, if you will, of what you saw with Ebola versus what we face now with COVID-19.
Well, the biggest difference is, of course, the scope of it. We haven't had a pandemic like this in a century, as people now know, and now we're familiar with it. But that's really the biggest difference. The Ebola outbreak, as previous outbreaks, was regional focused and spared most of the world, whereas that's not the case with COVID-19. There are other major differences. The mode of transmission of the two viruses. One is spread through contact. So that's why with Ebola, the primary victims were caregivers. It spread through caregiving, through taking care of your sick relatives, or if you're in a village where there's no professional nurses or doctors taking care of folks as a traditional healer, and then burying the dead, which in many religious traditions is the last act of caregiving. So this is a caregiver's disease through direct contact, whereas there's a respiratory pathogen with COVID-19. And again, you see caregivers often in the way of the virus, and that's why there's so much attention to PPE, because you can protect caregivers with that amazing cultural intervention of using in masks and social distancing, et cetera. So the scope, the way in which it's transmitted, these are major differences. The one that's playing itself out in our lives is that it's the social conditions that determine the spread of the virus and the effectiveness of our countermeasures. And in the United States, we're not in a clinical desert. We're not in the medical desert. We have staff, we have stuff, we have space or can build it. What we really lack is systems, and we saw that very much in the clinical desert as well. So they lacked everything and systems. I think there's been some improvement, though, in the places that endured these Ebola outbreaks. They're more familiar with what's required than the Americans were a March a year ago. And we've seen some encouraging efforts to address not just the Ebola outbreak in Guinea, but COVID across that region as well.
Your work has intersected with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who now figures very prominently in the lives of so many Americans who are trying to understand the developments of the pandemic, what it means. Can you tell us a story about Fauci and how you regard his work?
Well, Anthony Fauci has been the pioneer of global infectious disease in the United States or from the United States. A lot of people don't know that he has been in that current role that he holds now as director of NIAID, the largest branch of NIH. He's been in that position since the early 80s. Mm-hmm. When I began medical school in 1984, he was named that role. So for just the endurance of his engagement, that would be significant. But he's mentored people across the world in addition to the so many that he's mentored in the United States, and is really one of the architects behind President George W. Bush's AIDS plan. And so he's sort of famous across much of Africa for that reason. And now he's famous across the United States for a similar one. He is a sterling public servant. And the one story I would tell is over the last 20, 25 years, you know, I've taken to calling him And if it's a Saturday, you can be sure he'll be the one answering the phone in his office. He's a very accessible, generous stalwart of American medicine.
He also figured in the Ebola outbreak as well when one of your workers fell ill. What happened there?
Well, again, I hope it's obvious that he's also a great doctor. And his research, which has been used to be primarily on AIDS, his basic science research overlapped, of course, with the emergence of HIV as the major cause of death among young Americans, men and women. So he's developed a clinical response team as well. And when someone who was lucky enough to be an American citizen was unfortunate enough to contract Ebola in the course of the response, people largely went to what's called a biocontainment unit. There's one at Emory, there's one in Nebraska, and there's one at the NIH. And so Tony Fauci's team runs that unit, and they did a great job taking care of a number of Americans who fell ill. It's a small number, but they did a very sterling job on every score. And we learned a lot more in many ways from those cases because we had the staff space and systems to monitor their response. And we still have that, which is another reason the United States is not a medical desert.
We have Dr. Paul Farmer with us, professor at Harvard. He chairs the Global Health and Social Science Medicine at Harvard Medical School, written a dozen books, was part of the international effort to contain Ebola, focusing on clinical care. And taking your questions, how do you feel about the current accessibility to vaccines here and globally? How should this be approached to make sure the necessary people receive vaccines? 800-642-1234. Dr. Farmer, the Liberian citizen who became the first Ebola patient diagnosed in the U.S., Thomas Eric Duncan, he was visiting family in Dallas at the time in 2014. This became just a very fearful time. I lived near Dallas at the time, was a journalist there. What did the press get wrong in its portrayal of Ebola and the situation with Thomas Eric Duncan?
Well, I was in Liberia for part of that time, right around the time when he left. And he had been a caregiver of sorts, too, offering assistance to a young woman in distress who was about to deliver a baby. Unfortunately, it looks like she may have had Ebola. I'm not even sure about that, but she died. And in the course of that assistance, that was probably an exposure for him, went home on a regular commercial airline or went back to Dallas where his partner and their child, their teenage child, lived. And all that was legal and correct. And he also presented to an emergency room when he felt unwell and quite forthrightly stated that he had just returned from Liberia, which was at that very moment the place in the world with the most Ebola cases ever documented at any time. So, so far, so good. He needed emergency medical services and care, but the diagnosis was missed and he was sent home. Now, that's not really an answer to the question that you posed, what did the press get wrong? And, I, watching from Liberia is one thing, but reading some of it later is another. And first of all, one of the things we got wrong is to assume or fear overmuch that this would spread like wildfire in Texas or anywhere else in the United States, which it was not going to happen because we do have the space and systems to mount a response to this kind of a pathogen. So, and that was, of course, very hard on the patient, I'm sure, who died and on his surviving family. It was hard, I imagine, on the community as well. Unfortunately, these kind of social epidemics occur pretty much every time there's a major life-threatening epidemic as well.
You, I would imagine, have received many, many vaccines as you travel the world. Are you ever concerned about contracting disease?
Oh, sure. Anybody who is not afraid of becoming a casualty in the response to an epidemic or or another kind of disaster is probably not, these are not the people you want in the response. It is right and neat to be very fearful of these pathogens, and we were. And of course, vaccines are the most fabulous countermeasure imaginable because they confer that protection without going through all the misery. And of course, for many people, that misery is a path to exit since they don't have the staff, space, and systems they need to respond. Putting those in place is a very gratifying way to spend one's medical profession, I'll tell you.
Dr. Paul Farmer has spent decades working at the intersection of infectious disease, social inequality, public health, human rights. His latest book is called Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds. What have you experienced in medical care systems in poor and underserved communities? What do you want to know about social distancing, contact tracing in other countries? What does global health equity mean to you? Be part of this 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Dr. Paul Farmer after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're examining how Ebola spreads and kills and learning from the 2014 West African outbreak and how it can be more broadly inform where to target public health resources today in the battle we face with COVID. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and what an honor to have Dr. Paul Farmer, who has dedicated his life to advancing public health and human rights around the world. And in his latest book, he writes how he couldn't shake the feeling that Ebola was a fire that we had an ethical obligation to fight. But the priority was containment, not the delivery of clinical services. Why did Ebola spread so rapidly in some places and not in others? Why did it kill some, spare others? What questions do you have about social medicine? 800-642-1234. Dr. Farmer of Harvard University is with us for the hour. Dr. Farmer, let's take a look more closely at your organization, Partners in Health, which you founded to improve access to healthcare. What is it working on now with the fight against COVID?
Well, I would just say to, as a spoiler, that the majority of this group, which is really a large group across the world, about 20,000 people, the majority of attention has been turned to COVID. You know, nobody's had a choice in the matter. And I'm very proud of the work that my colleagues have done, particularly in Haiti and Rwanda, but in Sierra Leone, Liberia, Lesotho, the Navajo Nation, Massachusetts. You know, it's been very impressive to see this group rally together to protect the health and well-being of the people they're serving. We've learned a lot of lessons, of course, during the course of 30-plus years responding to health threats. And again, although they're usually the everyday threats that anybody might face, whether in Wisconsin or in rural Haiti, sometimes there are dramatic events like the earthquake or a major epidemic of cholera. But one thing we keep going back to is the material needs that humans have to protect themselves. They need staff, space, systems, and a lot of support to get through these kinds of challenges, to make it through alive. And so that's where we're turning our attention, trying not to forget all of the other problems that people face while attending to the new normal of COVID.
You know, we're confronted with this sobering inequality of vaccines in our country. Have you seen that elsewhere in the world, what we're confronting now with who gets a COVID vaccine?
The crisis that we're confronting now is just seen on a much larger scale elsewhere. I think that we're going to see a more rapid uptake of vaccination. We haven't hit any, we're not anywhere near grappling with vaccine hesitancy because there are such long lines of people who want this protection. And that's true elsewhere. For example, just last week in Rwanda, where people were waiting on triple tenterhooks to get vaccines, when they finally arrived, what we saw was not vaccine hesitancy, but people lined up to get the vaccine. So far, these are largely health workers, but they include community health workers. And that's another area where Partners in Health has a lot of experience. The majority of Partners in Health employees are probably community health workers, and most of them are working not too far from where they were born and raised. And so protecting them is protecting the backbone of the healthcare delivery system in many settings. And we not only need to do that in the United States, but we also need to have a lot more contact tracers and community health workers to help us get out of this crisis. But we will get out of this crisis because we have the vaccine, and we need to make sure that everybody has the vaccine, everybody who needs it, which is probably going to be most people, and to get ready for the impact of new variants on how protective those vaccines will prove to be in the future.
I want to ask you about something. The European Union has been discussing vaccine passports, or a sort of vaccine visa system, showing proof of vaccination as you travel internationally. What do you make of this idea?
Well, I mean, it's one that's familiar to many of us. For example, we have to have vaccine passports in the case of yellow fever if we've been in or near practically any country where there's been a case. So this is not only not new, it's really largely the history of public health in terms of its institutions. Prior to the World Health Organization was the Pan-American Health Organization, the oldest one. The United States has always been a part of it, and it was really established to promote commerce and trade by preventing ongoing transmission of pandemics and epidemics. That's the history of global health, is disease control, right? And that was, of course, during colonial rule, and there was unheard of ability to enforce some of these regulations in the colonies. And you had very much a control over care paradigm emerge there, beginning at about the same time that powerful new technologies in the form of vaccines were developed in Europe and the United States.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health. It's a nonprofit helping poor countries strengthen their medical systems. He was an international responder to the 2014 Ebola outbreak, and his latest book chronicles that response and his journey in fighting Ebola. You can join in with your questions about Ebola and this fight against COVID, 800-642-1234. Dr. Farmer, weak health systems, you say, are a legacy of colonial rule. How does colonialism affect the fight against a pathogen wreaking havoc on humanity?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've always been fascinated by, even as a student going between, let's say, Harvard and Haiti, was on the one side, you know, we're talking about a medical mecca. Boston punches way out of its weight class, if I haven't mangled that metaphor, in terms of medicine. I almost always mangle sports metaphors. But, you know, Haiti did not back then. And Haiti has punched out of its weight class in a lot of arenas, particularly the arena of modernity when it became the first nation to abolish slavery. So Haiti's got this... also has this international reputation, certainly on the continent of Africa, as having been capable of great things. And we've seen a lot of progress in central Haiti, where we work, over the course of the last 35, 40 years. But that says to us that you can irrigate a medical desert. What was the primary obstacle to irrigating the medical desert with staff, space, and systems for the 20th century? It's been colonial rule. And some of this is pretty spectacular. Like when I went to Sierra Leone for the first time, I just couldn't believe that the British would have been there for so long. And I'm talking about centuries, not just the usual, you know, century of European colonial rule in Africa. They could be there so long and establish exactly zero medical schools, and even more astoundingly, zero nursing schools. So that's how you make a clinical desert, and that's what I wanted to do with this book, Kate, was to answer, and maybe for the first time make the time to answer the question, how do you create a medical desert? How do you strip a place of the staff, space, and systems that might naturally flourish there? And, you know, if you had to choose one word on that continent, it would be colonial rule, extractive colonial rule. And, you know, people say, well, that was a long time ago. And, you know, for me, I would just think, well, I was alive before Sierra Leone, you know, became independent. It's not that long ago. And, of course, the memory of not having SAFSTEP space and systems becomes a reality every year that you aren't able to irrigate that desert. And, you know, we have a lot of reparating to do, of reparative work to do, to help build those systems where they're needed most. And, you know, that's also an insurance policy against a lot more of those zoonotic spillovers that you mentioned earlier.
And where do natural resources fall into this? Extracting, you know, extracting minerals, the diamonds. What about greed?
Well, you know, this has been the primary debate in discussion of this kind of conflict on that continent, greed or grievance. And most people who invoke the paradigm of greed or grievance underline greed, right? But there's a lot of real grievance to be heard as well. And in the end, you know, whether the cause of this profound insufficiency is greed or grievance, the treatment of the insufficiency is the same: staff, stuff, space, systems, and support. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that, you know, it's not always possible to stop and take the time to ask, how did this medical desert come to be desiccated? How did this happen? But that's an important and respectful kind of exercise as well, to know why the people that you're serving are in extremity like this. And in any case, I found it fascinating to learn about the history of the place.
Samantha is joining us from Whitehall with a question. Hi, Samantha. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have kind of two questions. I'm 39, going to be 40 in August. How do you determine who gets the vaccine first, you know, and all that? And also the second question is, I have a neighbor of mine, we were talking about it where I live, she's old enough to go get the vaccine when her Gunderson, where she goes, had called her about setting up an appointment. She said no, she's afraid she's going to get a lot of symptoms from getting this. Now, how do you help those kind of people that they have health problems like she does? She's got some underlying health problems that she should go get it, but she's too afraid to go get it.
Samantha, yeah, brings up really good questions about the COVID
really
vaccine.
Good question. Mm-hmm. Very, very good questions. Thank you, Samantha. On the first question, how do we decide? As I mentioned earlier, there's one way of deciding is where are the outbreaks, where are the clusters, right? But we have not done that yet in the United States. That is the example that comes from Ebola in Guinea, right, of ring vaccination. And there you're saying who gets the vaccine is going to be determined by proximity to the risk of exposure. And we've done it in a different way here in the United States so far, and that is to assess risk. And we know that the greatest risk, as you point out, Samantha, is borne by the elderly, particularly those with other slings and arrows of living a long time, a comorbid disease. So that's a risk-based approach to deciding who's first in line. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy about it, as we all know. If we could layer those two approaches together, that is assessment of risk. And when you say assessment of risk, for example, if there's a meatpacking plant or a prison where there are huge, already documented to have been huge epidemics, those are places with a great deal of risk that is unrelated to age of those at risk, right? So that's another risk-based approach, but it also is informed by an understanding of the epidemics we've seen in the United States, which have been very often in congregate settings like that.
Medical anthropologist Paul Farmer has spent decades advancing global health equity in poor nations. He chairs global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School. You can join in. How do you feel about COVID now and what happened during Ebola? Have you worked with Doctors Without Borders or other medical relief missions? What can you say about this experience and what you learned? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Paul Farmer here on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Paul Farmer, a global health pioneer. He responded to the epicenter of the 2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa, which was also ground zero for civil wars in the 90s and early 2000s. Dr. Paul Farmer writes, a long and sorry chain of events ending in war constituted the perfect storm that led to its runaway epidemic. Farmer's latest book is Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Dr. Farmer, you're talking there about risk and how to allocate vaccines. What is the impact of risk when you shut down your borders, trying to get in and out of the U.S., as you reflect on what happened in Ebola and getting in and out of West Africa?
Well, this has been a thorny issue, Kate. You know, a lot of public health folks I know are not big fans of border closures and have argued that it serves to block the transport and transfer of resources. And I've always found that compelling. Then again, I've never been a head of state, and nor will I be, or a minister of health. In the United States, we call that the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but most of the world, it's the Minister of Health. I've never been in that role, although I've worked a lot with people who have been in that role. And so I understand their obligation, which is a social contract, to worry about people in their district or in their country. Right? That's the job of every head of state. But heads of state also know that, by definition, a pandemic is spread across multiple continents. And therefore, it really does become a quest also for the more enlightened leaders to think about, you know, how artificial borders are. They're also largely on that continent, the creation of people sitting in places like Berlin, Germany, carving up the continent. So, you know, on the one hand, we take refuge in knowing that we have elected authorities worried only about us. On the other, we know that's not how the viruses think, you know, to anthropomorphize them for a second. So it makes sense socially and politically, but it doesn't make sense epidemiologically. And that's where we're stuck right now as a globe, right? We have not only COVID nationalism with everybody circling the wagons and closing the borders and saying this is how many cases we have in my country. We also have vaccine nationalism, which all too often bends towards vaccine apartheid. And that's the great challenge before us in the days and weeks ahead, not just the months.
Let's bring in Scott now in Baldwin. Hi, Scott.
Yes. I'm very disappointed, obviously, as most Americans are. The only way to control an epidemic is massive testing, quarantine, and tracing. And this country did a pathetic job of that under the Trump administration. And why in the heck didn't epidemiologists and doctors like you, and definitely Fauci, get out in front and demand that this be done? And let's not do this again. Yeah. We need some type of doctors to get together, get on national TV, and not let politics take over science.
Let's let Dr. Farmer jump in here.
Well, Scott, I'm afraid, you know, I have to agree with you. I mean, the reason I'm hesitating is, you know, I feel some shame in that, too. I would say, not at all defensively, that that's just what we tried to do. And in the state of Massachusetts, we worked with the governor, Governor Charles Baker, to set up the first contact tracing program, a statewide program in the United States. But it has been, as you said, Scott, it's hard to point to a lot of success in any contact tracing initiative. And you're right that we epidemiologists, to use the term, you know, loosely to describe doctors in infectious disease as well, we should have done more. There's no way to say we did enough when we have this kind of a death toll. And, you know, when we acknowledge, as you did, Scott, that we have performed uniquely poorly among the nations and certainly among those with the resources that we have. So I would just say a lot of us feel committed to the vision that you laid out, that we have an apolitical, you know, epidemic-focused or threat-focused response that would be taken up as evenly as is necessary when we're facing a pandemic. So critique accepted.
Paul Farmer is with us, Chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, as we look at the Ebola crisis and what can be learned. Louise from Viroqua called in, couldn't stay with us, Dr. Farmer. Louise is wondering if there were variants, is or are variants of Ebola, and how that parlays as we look at separate vaccinations that may be needed to combat the coronavirus variants.
That's a superb question, and I thank Louise for it. There are indeed variants. In fact, you know, the term could be used to describe any pathogen is a variant of, you know, with substantial sometimes mutations, and sometimes with ones that are not deemed substantial or substantive, right? So what we're seeing now with the emergence of these new variants is going to happen whenever and wherever there's ongoing community transmission of the pathogen, because that's what allows it to mutate and spread. So a vaccine can not only shut down the disease and shut down by shutting down transmission, it shuts down or diminishes the flow of new variants, right? So to stop variants now, we use the vaccines that we have. With Ebola, it looks as if the vaccine remains as effective against any new variants that may be emerging, for example, in Guinea or in, and I shouldn't say that with too much conviction, Kate, because we don't know the data yet on the variants from Guinea, but on the variants in the Congolese epidemics that have just now simmered down, we've seen evidence of effectiveness of the vaccine in spite of mutation. So, you know, the big question that Louise poses is, what are we going to have to do going forward if we can't shut off that spigot of mutation, which is ongoing community transmission? And that's where we are again right now in the United States.
Yeah. As you look forward here to public health in our country, the U.S., will we be doing things differently as you see this pandemic evolving?
Oh, I think we have to. We have so chronically underinvested in public health in the United States compared to our resources and compared to our investments in biotechnology, basic science, and clinical services for the acutely ill or injured. And we can preserve all those gains and grow them, but we have to start investing in a national public health delivery system with adequate protections for everybody, and particularly for the kind of people we're calling essential workers now.
Dr. Farmer, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Dr. Paul Farmer, Chair of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School, author of the book Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History. We have a link to it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.